complaining about torture who may not be the victim. I presume then if complainant is taken out, that you would feel that, that it's the definition is most.
Reread that as the other definition of doing it might have changed of consequence is public official. Members will recall that we've taken out that the previous paragraph C there, any person acting with consent or quiescence of a person contemplating paragraph A or B. And that wording has been transferred to clause 3 itself, where we get to the act constituting torture, but we will get there in a moment. The objects of interpretation in clause 2, again, there's the omission in 2.1a of the word or other cruel or unusual inhuman treatment or punishment. Again, that is in line with the decision that's been taken to spoke on torture. In clause 3, members will recall that there were two options considered here. One was just to amend the definition, as we've done here, but we've got an alternative option that is basically just following the words of convention itself. If we look at the original amendment, what's been done is by taking out the word by a public official or any person acting on behalf of a public official, then we change in order for such purposes as, I think it's the preference of the commission, and then that public official features again at the bottom on the next page in paragraph B, where we insert where such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent of or acquiescence of a public official. And that links up with what is in the definition to public official as well. Then the alternative option was, as members requested, if we could maybe live with or prefer to follow the route of just using the wording in the convention. It was also suggested by some of the commentators members will recall. I'll just read through it very briefly for the purpose of act torture and act omission. By which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or her, or a third person, information or a confession, punishing him or her for an act he or she or a third person has committed, or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or her for a third person, or for any reason based on discrimination of any kind, when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or the consent or acquiescence of a public official, but it does not include pain or suffering arising only from inherent or incidental to lawful sanctions. I may add that on our side we do not have a particular problem. We think it's really the same thing. Just my, and this is a very personal preference, members will see that in that wording, the expression a third person appears key times. That is a bit foreign in the context in our legislation. I would personally prefer to say at least any other person. That's not in legislation referred to a third person, but that is really a matter of preference too.
Last point. I mean, Mr. Zalangi, you drafted this bill. No, okay, all right. No, because I just see third person is in the bill that was introduced, not in well, it's just riddled in the existing one.
Yes, and I think it was influenced by the convention itself, too. That follows the wording of the convention. But this is actually something I picked up this morning when I just checked what we're going to discuss. But unfortunately, when you're from the drafting side, you can never read something without feeling that I can actually improve on it.
Yeah. I mean, so it seems that the two difference between the two options is basically just the reworked option, the reworked first clause 3 is simply just the thing broken down into A, B, and C to make it easier to read. So it doesn't really need to make any difference. Mr. London, I think, making a new proposal, and that is to change third person to any other person, which I suppose is fine, but I don't have a... I mean, I think overall my problem is I don't think tort is properly defined at all. And we usually are much more specific when we create crime. But anyway, that's the convention we've got to live with. I don't know whether you feel that the prosecutors, the magistrates, judges will find the A, B, and C's easier to read. I don't know.
Yeah. Either would be acceptable, but I can't help thinking perhaps we should simply go with the convention definition. I see how much trouble you've already had with NGOs insisting that this was missing and that was missing. And what you've done now is to put back what was missing. But why not just go with the convention definition? I would tend to do that. And I wouldn't even worry about the third person if that's what they put it in. But if people on balance feel they want any other person, then that's obviously an either or. But speaking for myself, I would simply go for the convention definition, although I think you've set up all the problems. So two positions, but well, we can divide that in the end, really.
Maybe that in terms of when it comes to finalizing the options, that maybe the first clause 3 has any other person, and you keep the alternative option as it is, so that in a sense the choice that we're faced is, do we follow the exact wording of the convention, or do we make it slightly more South African? No, I'm not. I'm in two minds as well. I mean, I suppose it will be international jurisprudence that will develop what the definition of torture is. So to some extent it makes sense that someone repeats the thing. But I, as I said, I think my suggestion would change the first one to any other person. I mean, keep the alternative option as its word.
Thanks very much. We will do that. In clause 4. Small changes, but it's actually quite significant. We've taken out in 4.1 any public official, and we're just saying each person who commits torture, attempts to commit torture, instigates, etc. The reason being, I did not need to remind members that many other commentators, but what boils down to is you will still either be a public official, or you must have acted with a consent or etc. or a public service fund. Change the person, and then at least that person reading the bill will get the fright of his or her life if he contemplates torture. Absolutely. Yeah. On 2, it is just to bring that in line with the wording used in at the bottom of 1, condition liable to, condition liable to. On the next page, subsection 4, again we've done what I think some of the commentators commented on and committed reference in this regard by saying no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, including but not limited to the state of war and in certain national security or any public business that may be involved as a justification for torture.
What did you say about non-derogable rights, which under what is a state of emergency, so that would be covered here? I think it speaks about a public emergency, which would be covered. I just want to make sure that we do cover those aspects as well, which that covers. You cover it in any case. Yeah. I think it's something about emergency. But non-durable rights.
There are some very good rights here, freedom, security of person.
Where is that?
Well, it's in clause 37 of the Constitution, sir. It's a table of non-very good rights. The start of in 37 state of emergency might be only blah, blah.
I call it
statement.
Yes. Shouldn't we refer, because the Constitution
refers to, I mean, the state of emergency then, instead of a public emergency. I mean, what is a public emergency? Okay. The same thing. So should we change public emergency to state of emergency, because that's then specified in the Constitution?
No. Non-derogable. What did we do with bodily integrity, right? Is it derogable? Are you sure?
Dignity entirely. life environment does not.
Human dignity, life entirely.
Thank you. If I may continue. In 5, we just say an accused person as opposed to an accused person, because we've got definition also of an accused person. I think that the changes here are related to the substitution for complaint with victim. Then in 5F, we use up any kind of weapon, harm, threaten or intimidate the victim. Those words will refer to the incident. G, the infliction of serious mental or physical harm to the victim. Those are the other changes there. Okay. The top, in terms of the new sexual offense. To the offences of rape and indecent assault, and I'm not sure whether that should one make that broader to include the other offences in terms of the Sexual Offences Act as well.
Sure, it could probably be even just to just say whether the victim was sexually assaulted.
So we go with sexually assaulted and then we find.
Okay, then if I might continue to the next law, 6, sexual restriction. In 6.1 we just change the person to accused person and we omit it to be charged. We said C, the word lawfully omitted. I need not elaborate on that, but omitted preferred that. And 2 again we insert accused to accused person. Next change, Chief, appears in clause 8. A very small one in 8.2, we just change the must to shall. President shall cause programs to be developed in order to. This is one instance where we prefer shall as opposed to must, because it's an obligation. I don't quite understand how this is possible, because it's the same version that I think mine says must take an out and shall. I suppose must would probably be in line with it. Given the bottom of the previous clause, it says the substitution must be conducted. In this instance, then I suppose must. Completely up to the committee. Of course, no, make absolutely no difference. So, we will represent that for you. See, then on the next page, we included the provide assistance and advice to alleged victims of torture to cater for those attractions are implicated free rates. This issue where there's not necessarily a complaint to a cat already, but you already want to assist a person.
every now and then, I might just inform the committee that if you're not likely to finalize this matter today, which I believe you're not likely to do, if all things go according to plan, there's a likelihood that I will next week, or by the end of next week, attend a meeting in Geneva of involving other people from other countries presently involved in drafting legislation on torture, or who have just gone through that process, and maybe there will be something that I can bring back to the committee that might be of some use.
Reasons why we shouldn't finalize today, Article 3. That was the issue of the refoulement. You left it out of the bill on the basis that the common law, I suppose, was determined by the Concord. I think you left it out of the bill due to some unhappiness by some other government departments. And the basis was, well, it's already in our law in terms of the Constitutional Court decisions. But really, is it not better having it all in? And given that we got criticism in the public submission, should we not have this issue in? And basically state the court judgment.
That's fine. Would the committee object if we had a discussion with Mr. Jeffrey on this to apply our minds as to what exactly we've got in mind and what exactly we should be looking at here? Because I'm not too sure. In the absence of a concrete proposal, exactly what we should follow.
See, Article 3 is left up, okay, of the convention.
Article
3 or extradite a person to another state where there's substantial grounds believing that he or she would be in danger of being subject to torture, and then the competent authority shall take into account all relevant considerations, the existence of the state, in the state concerned for consistent pattern of gross flagrant mass violations of human rights. Maybe even just the wording of three, because it's not sort of absolute. I guess, you know, there is a problem and one sees it from the Dewani case. There is a problem of people hanging on much longer than they should do. But, it is limited to a consistent pattern of gross, flagrant, or mass violations. So it's not as wide as any form of violation. But it's a question of Article 3. I mean, as I said, I presume it was left out on the basis that, you can't do it anyway. We did have it when we did that convention with Iran, and it came up. I think you weren't, you weren't the official that was dealing with that, but some of the committee members raised concerns. But can you have a look at whether Article 3 is adequate and would not cause us any new difficulties that don't already exist in our case law?
After the previous judgment, Constitutional Court, and where was the Mohammed, in which court? I mean, there really is no argument. And those, I mean, at least the latter deals with the death penalty. And I don't think the judge has reached the matter of each other. But it nevertheless follows, doesn't it? In Mohammed, did Mohammed address other forms of gross flagrant mass violation?
I don't think so. I think they just... Well, they may have done. I didn't read it actually.
Very well, you know, we will do that. I don't think it's such a big deal.
No, I need a one-on-one with you.
Yeah, no, but another thing.
Oh, okay.
Just gained an experience with the trafficking bill, we call the trafficking bill, which was also the prevention of, you know, sort of, yeah. So just whether the clause 8 are we creating any rights or expectations? And should there maybe not be provision for regulations to define it more clearly? Basically, the issue of education generally, education for public officials, for prison officials effectively. I suppose the more difficult one is providing assistance and advice to alleged victims of torture and training. So it's more, I suppose, the one I'm worried about is C. Yeah.
How are you going to define what an alleged victim is? I mean, I can convey I was tortured. I mean, then I'm going to, you know, qualify for all kinds of unnamed assistance and advice.
Yeah.
It's kind of being like a trafficking problem. You know, what are we going to open ourselves up to?
You see, government can do more than in the bill, but it can't do less. So it can specify victims of torture who, and then it would, I think, be clear that a victim of torture is somebody found by court to be a victim. And it can then provide assistance and advice to alleged victims who haven't been caught. But the problem is if it's worded as it is, then we do have the trafficking scenario of, you know, where do you limit it and people taking chances. I've got, you know, I'm an illegal immigrant. I got tortured by Home Affairs officials. I'm only talking about it in there at the border post or whatever. Now I need assistance. Yeah, yeah.
What if you do, somebody really has been, and then you aren't obliged to help them? I think we should be obliged. But how do we, I think we need to try and apply them just to whether there may be some more objective criteria that we can look at. Or maybe if a criminal charge has been laid in, or something like that. Maybe because, yeah, I mean, if someone really has been tortured, then there isn't an obligation. Would we not be calling file of the prevention? Maybe just check.
Change address and has an enforceable right. I mean, that they've already got. So there isn't any obligation in the convention, is that? Or have to sit.
I wonder if the thing that I want to address maybe is not the complainant, and then I would like to go back to complainant. And what they maybe intend is if a person is complaining about torture, giving a piece of paper or telling, okay, you've got this and that and the other rights and you may do this, that and the other, and if that is the intention, then maybe regulations could be correct, then you can say provide assistance and advice then either to the complainant or alleged victim in the prescribed manner, and then we can prescribe whatever is necessary. But that's totally up to the committee then.
Parties shall make these offences punishable by appropriate penalties which take into account their grave nature. No penalties. Now, in light of Prince Punishment,
The penalties in clause 4. That's quite grave. It's only imprisonment.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yes. And then the grave nature is clause 5 is best to draw attention to that, yes.
It was on the argument of Dr. Munson thought that this was left room for non-custodial sentences, which I think is just plain wrong. And it is partially on the construction of the word liable that he makes this argument. I did wonder why you moved liable from one spot in the sentence to another. But I mean, clearly what is anticipated here is custodial sentence, including imprisonment for life. And I think surely you can leave it to the court at that point. But why did you move the word liable?
Because in the previous sentence, liable appears in 4-1 at the end, on conviction liable too. In 4-2, liable was on conviction liable. So it is liable on conviction, and then we just make for consistency. So of course, the other arguments were, there were quite a number of proponents of minimum sentences here, but I think the committee has got that at length and decided that they're not going to go against it. And I think at the last time, we also recognized the fact that there are various degrees of torture. So at the time, the committee was quite satisfied with the provision.
Yeah, I think the way it's worded is fine. I mean, you know, if what happens if Mr. I don't know, for the life of Pinochet comes to visit and sort of deemed not to be completely dug out, but he's really an advanced age, and the court may say, well, we find you guilty, but we're going to sentence you to half the rest in a office, you know, which...
Well, dangerous for the other inmates as well.
If I may, then, on the other issue of regulation, is there a desire then that we should add something to regulation? Yeah, but I would just caution against make it obligatory. As soon as you put in as prescribed, for example, things that you cannot implement if there's no regulations. But if you have a general regulation clause, that's fine. You can make regulations on anything that you need to, but I would prefer that once this bill is signed and published, as it stands, there's actually nothing preventing its implementation immediately. And then you can add on them when it comes to regulations, things like that.
Yeah, that's fine, but the reason we want it is we don't want to create huge expectations and great increase in expenditure. So as long as you can word for your chair like that, that's fine.
Thank you.
Go back one point here, just to refresh our memory, from the Lawyers for Human Rights Commission. The optional protocol, which South Africa has signed but not ratified, contains provisions for the establishment of a national preventative mechanism, which gives effect to the obligation in Section 2 of the optional to take effect to preventative measures. Accordingly, we urge Parliament to consider the inclusion of statutory framework for the establishment such as detention monitoring mechanism. In addition to domestic mechanism, it's also important to emphasize government's duty to cooperate, blah, 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 blah. Therefore, we propose a bill to address the national preventative mechanism as described in OPCAT, which South Africa signed but not ratified. But I think that that does partially address that we've looked at this before.
I at one point thought, why don't we do OPCAT at the same time as CAT? But I think that let's do the UNCAT. You know, I think the issue with the OPCAT is that there are existing mechanisms. Are they sufficient? So you've got the inspecting judge of prisons, for example. You've got the IPID. And I think that when it comes to the ratification of OPCAT, let the department come in with new amendments. But, you know, we don't want to set up a new body, which is further expenditure. We've got to look at what is already there. How can that be added to? Is that sufficient? If not, how can it be added to those kinds of things?
We really need to create this crime, and we must move with speed. We've already sat on this a very long time. Not we, but South Africa. We need to create this crime. The minute we start looking at mechanisms, we all know what will happen. It'll have transversal, interdepartmental effect. The thing will get bogged down for at least a year in this committee with various ministries. It'll take much, much, much longer, and that's why I feel quite strongly we will simply create this crime, get it under the statute book, and the other can follow. And as the Honourable Secretary says, we do have, I said, we do have the inspecting judge. And if they need to be amplified, that can happen in due course. The urgency is to create the crime of torture.
Anything else, Alderman? Given that Mr. DeLonga won't be here next Friday,
Langer must stay.
Stay, yes.
Don't stay.
You didn't drop anything.
My judge had a
specific invitation. If I stay, yes. Nobody else will go.
You'd have to change passports. Oh, the point I'm making is, do we want him back before he leaves, or?
Basically, I mean, when are you leaving?
Friday next week.
Friday and Saturday next week. I'm returning Monday. Monday week.
Friendly NCOP, they're already like got a huge backlog.
Well, the point I'm making is, do we want him back before he leaves?
No. To listen to if there is anything that he can inform us about the injury, but then rather let him come back over there.
Right. We agreed on it? Right. Thank you, Mr. DeLonga.
Thank you, Chairman. Just to confirm that tomorrow should be a court. I will this afternoon give the ball to Mr. Samana and this.
There is one mandate we're giving him. It's chocolate. I know Gillian likes it. Yeah. All right. Yes. All right. Honourable members, thank you, Mr. DeLonga, and the rest of your team. You're welcome to sit and listen or whatever you should do. Process, honourable members. I've received a flood, literally a flood of stuff from Advocate Nonki Shai. Yes. I deliberately kept it from everyone because I didn't want everyone to be sitting on my neck. So you need to determine what is the process we're going to follow. One. Two, it will be open. There have been people from the office who have requested an opportunity to come and address us. And there may be those who want to do so behind closed doors. Should we accommodate those? flood of documentation I've received, should we make it available to the media? Those are the issues I want you to address. And anything else relating to this?
Before you even reach that point, sir, and excuse me, the Public Protection Act is lying on top of this file. It says, whose inactive clause reads as follows. Be therefore enacted by the Parliament of the Republic. Much like that. Chair, very recent. It's 94.
94, yes.
Chair, before you ask us this question about how we should... for me, give me a clear idea of exactly what is now in play, because we have seen some, the DA has seen some things, but not everything, I think. But we have seen the letter from the Public Protector to the Speaker, referring to what, a number of petitions and complaints. One of them was from the PPSA, who appear to be public servants, the investigators at the That is the long document citing various mistakes and forms of maladministration, if you like. Then there was a document written by a task team which the Public Protector had appointed and looking at these complaints.
Mm-hmm.
But as I understood, it's not just the merits of what their nature was. Then there was a response which was written by, I think, is it a Public Protector herself, to some of the allegations. Such as the one that the CEO, Mr. Mkhitwa, had given himself a bonus on the basis of a forged signature, the signature forged being that of the Deputy Public Protector, that upon challenge he was said to have paid the amount back, either in full or in installment. There is a dispute about that. But to me, the question still arises, was there a forged signature? If so, what is being done? But those, I think, are the three things that I have seen now, but there are clearly other documents.
Yes.
The one, would you just enumerate them for us? Because, I mean, there's more than one. There's the whole allegation of how things are not run correctly in that office.
Mm-hmm.
There are the anonymous ones, which perhaps you'd be good enough to summarize for us. There's the further issue, which we picked up when the Justice Department appeared for us, that the Public Protector may, in fact, be exceeding, she may be ultra-virus in some of the inquiries she undertakes. So, I mean, what is the range of things before us, please?
Well, all right. I haven't read all these documents from the Deputy Public Protector. It's far too many of them. And I didn't want to start reading them until you, the committee, had said this is how we're going to move forward. Otherwise, I'm going to sit and read all this stuff and you say, well, it's junk, we're not interested, and we're not moving forward in it. So I thought I should make it available to you. My PA is it's a lot. It's really annexures after annexures, and honestly, it's a lot. So yes, you're right, Ms. Smuts. There's the anonymous allegation, all right? The one which I took through in the Western. That was responded to by a letter from the Public Protector asking the Speaker for Parliament to investigate. There's this top team report. Now, I'm not sure whether the stuff from Advocate Shai is part of this top team report. That we'd need to ascertain once we've read all these documents. You're right about the forged signature. Forged signature is an offense. So paying the money back is one thing. There's still the other bit. Yes. The matter of the report on the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, that's something, now, if you want to make it part of this, we can do that. I know that Mr. Jeffrey said last week sometime, we need to bring the Public Protector back here in order for her to explain this anomaly. Because quite frankly, the question that arose in my mind over the weekend is, has the office padded the statistics in order to justify their need for additional investigation. So where she makes reference to outstanding judgments, that's outside her mandate. But that is something that you would need to look at as well.
A few
She's clearly yes. Ultra virus, her own act, never mind any other statute.
And the Constitution. Yes. Ms. Schaefer, Mr. Sibanyoni, Mr. Jeffrey, Lisa? No.
I think given the sensitivity that exists at the moment, it would be wise for us all to look at at all documentation first before we make a decision as to whether we should go public and so how and so on. That's my suggestion.
Sitting behind closed doors, I think there's a case for it when and if we see whistleblowers. Whistleblowers do need to be protected. It's going to be very difficult to decide who is bona fide and who is not. If we go that far, I know that the ASMA ad hoc committee that sat on the allegations of sexual harassment by the deputy public sector against the then public protector, I know that it's interesting, they didn't go into the merits either. They never reached the question whether sexual harassment has occurred. It's a very prudent course we may wish to take a leaf from their book.
What?
They basically were just establishing, because you know, dear, I think, well, we'll discuss that later. But a thing like this would turn into, yeah, we could settle into next year. And what is it simply, they did not take what they call a role of judicial inquiry or tribunalism. It is not the function of the committee to investigate and make findings on the allegations of Dr. Alex. Instead, their function, very pertinently, was to assess the extent of operational problems and to make recommendations to overcome operational problems. They're very limited. And I'm not sure we can do very much more.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was going to address myself only on the question of the anonymous people to say, in order to maybe guarantee their safety and the like, or to make it possible for them, we should not open up, because if a person decides to be anonymous, may have a reason to scare to be public, and then if it's publicized, that person you will never see, never come forward. But if some sort of some protection is guaranteed, I think they will come forward, and then we'll determine whether or not those allegations are genuine. I think
protected disclosures. Christine is shaking her head vigorously there. Mr. Swart and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Chair, we need to look into the documentation that is forwarded to us. I think the first step to look at. We've got a very heavy program. We've also got to be very careful not to become embroiled in having a tribunal here. And I'm thankful, the Dean, that you pointed out what our extent is.
Sure.
Because we end up then having cross-examination, witnesses, all types of things, and that process can then be taken out of view. I think that we've got to be very careful how we deal with this. I would think that we need to ascertain the extent. What is the extent of operational problems? I think that's the angst of Parliament. But let's look at the documentation, and then we can understand. We might want to silo issues into this issue, that issue we can address with great caution, and then prioritize it with bear in mind the priority of legislation that we're dealing with as well. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Jeffrey and then Mr. Lanimacher.
I think, obviously it's not a tribunal, we're not going to be, but we need to, bear in mind, firstly, that this request was made by the public protector herself, and referring at that point an anonymous complaint to the Parliament. I presume she wanted it to Parliament, the National Assembly, to deal with it, because these anonymous things keep coming. So I think we need to find out what the problems are to begin with. We've got the anonymous complaint the public protector referred to. There is then the Shai document, which already seems, looking at the newspapers a fortnight ago, is in the media. And I think we need to invite anyone else to make written submissions who has a problem. I don't think we can avoid that. I think we're inviting them to come and speak to us if we're inviting them to make written submissions. I'm raising that, I just see Dean's hand going up, but I'm raising it because on the basis that the whole reason the public protector referred it to us in the first place
was the plethora of complaints. So let's give everybody who's got something to say an opportunity to write to us and tell us what it is that they want to say. I don't think we've got any way around that. I mean, I'm just hearing all the muttering on my left and my right. Okay, the left didn't matter, but the right. Okay. But it's fine in writing. And then I think that, look, as far as the issue of media access to the documents, I mean, obviously we do want to protect a whistleblower who wants to be anonymous. We'd rather see them rather than having them being anonymous. But I think as much as possible should be in the open, because otherwise things are leaked anyway. So the Shai document is already out in the public domain. And it's better for the media to see for themselves what's there than to have it to be selectively fed it.
Okay. Without really trying to preempt the outcome of our discussion on the documentation that we've got before us, I think we need to probably look at the extent of the problem. And the technical consideration, the busy schedule that this committee has got, we may actually maybe have to recommend that there should be a special forum to deal with this, just to be sure that the process becomes a fair process that will, on the other hand, also protect the whistleblowers. And I guess if you've got a structure that's going to be having a sole responsibility of dealing with this, it will then manage to allow it to actually move in that way. Because one thing is, the minute this gets out into the media, even if we are saying we shouldn't take it to the media, we don't know how things go to the media, then there will always be questions. So we need to come up with a process that will actually limit that, so that we address all that is actually being presented to us in a way that will actually help us to come to a situation where we close the matter.
I am saying, if I understand you, that another body must be involved.
I'm thinking so, because this seems to be a... Let's look at the... In fact, we are going to read documentation.
Uh-huh.
Let's look at the documentation. Engage on the documentation. This is why I said I don't want to preempt the process. Because out of the process, my feeling is that we need to find that this is too much of a big process for us to manage to handle ourselves. We can therefore have to recommend a special committee to deal with it.
I worry about your statement that we can't be fixed and someone else can.
I'm not saying we're going to request another committee because we can't be fixed. I'm just emphasizing that the process itself, there must be fairness within it. The process that will also protect the whistleblowers. So nobody must be compromised by the process.
May I just say for the record, openness certainly is the default position. And at all times we will insist on openness. It is for the specific purpose of the protection of the identity of whistleblowers in circumstances where they may suffer occupational or other detriment. That I say that one would in fact look at closing doors. Chair, I was thinking along the same lines as my colleague, Connor. But we can't judge or decide this before we have in fact seen the rest of your documentation. And it is a burden in itself to wade through all this stuff, if I may say so. A lot of it is pity in the extreme. It's the kind of internal, in the revenge kind of office politics that play out anywhere, but also at the afternoon, unfortunately. I mean, there's the allegation about the public protector taking with her on her travels one of the persons from the catering department so that the lady can put the tea bag in the cup of tea and serve the cup of tea to the public protector. There's a response to the effect that this is a person with her, who showed promise and... Yes.
And you've seen it.
What I want to suggest is, after we've seen more documentation, one of the things I hope that one can think of is the Public Service Commission, the DAP 10 body. But I'm not sure, but they certainly do look at allegations or complaints and make recommendations. They may be inasmuch as these do appear to be civil servants working as a public protector. I'm not sure they should be, it's a certain line, but they are. And inasmuch as they are public servants, perhaps the Public Service Commission, which is a very, very expert body, can look at some of the organizational difficulties with which, honestly, if they become very petty, we should not be seized. But apart from that, we can't prejudge it, as Tana said, but apart from that, I certainly we can be, we most certainly will be fair. We certainly are qualified. And inasmuch as the TAP lines are accountable solely to us, we do have a duty to try to sort this out.
Yeah, thanks. And I agree. I'm a little uncomfortable about not being involved with it. If there's involvement in particular, I think we as a committee which should report should actually be involved in it. But yeah, maybe if it's some kind of on the sort of later matters regarding organisational stuff, you could maybe. But as it is the ending, my main point is I was just concerned about the Jeffrey's comment about taking submissions, because we're going to open it up for anyone and everyone. We are going to be flooded with a whole lot of things about people saying, you leave public sector alone. So if you meant that, then I don't agree.
I understand what you mean. It's confined to the people in the office.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. No, then that's fair enough. And because, at the moment, we only have one contact. We haven't got the shark stuff at the moment, so I don't think, I'd just caution the making decisions based on stuff we actually haven't even got yet.
All right, I'll then, my apologies. Honourable Shabbat Tola. And I do apologize.
My subsequent is that the public protection of the so it means that document is very important. It should not be, it should be led by the public.
It will be.
Yeah, and the other one, the four you know, if I don't understand, once we have got a payment arising out of the false document, that is serious, very serious. It can't be paid off, settled by a person paying by say, it's got to be investigated. And disciplinary steps must be just on that before we go any other way. You know, in the last release of the Auditor General, he was complaining about no consequence or anything. That is enough to forge a signature. Let alone that his benefit, that is another. Because there is that the benefit that arose out of the service. The last one was the setting up another point to be suggested by my colleague. I don't know, but I think we should actually allow every member to see the document so that we apply our money sitting from the same information like the servant and other colleagues. Because if you just wait to finish the size of all of us we might maybe miss an opportunity of the wisdom of other colleagues. It actually is, according to the Constitution, the public protects these accountable bodies. We need to look at the things because of that. Before we even think of engaging any other people, we are the people responsible. I'm just thinking, as we do with the discussion, I was just thinking a lot of the comment that Professor Chubok made in our class about my country. He said, you see, history will judge us very well. Because all of us in this parliament, we knew there were problems with women. Not one of us said anything. And here, we have got a very important problem of our public perspective. There are problems. Very great problems. That is why there is a shower of information. And
if he is going to say there were letters sent by anonymous and known people to that committee, and the committee that is directed to the committee did not know about it. This is related, and we should have an answer.
Would you agree that forgery being an offence, there should have been charges made?
We don't know. We need to establish what everything is. So I agree with
then look, why weren't charges made?
Yeah, that's an issue, and the charges should be made. That kind of thing. We don't know what has happened. We need to get everything in first. That was with regard to the annual report.
Okay, can we move off this now? All right. Between my PA, myself, my PA, and Mr. Ramana, we'll get all that documentation together. I'm downloading it from my mailbox onto a flash drive. I tried emailing it to him, and at one point, it wouldn't send. Oh, okay, there you go. Too big. I thought it was. All right, we move off this. What else is just...
Where do we... I think there was going to be a general discussion on the annual report process. But while it's specifically on the public protector, the office came here, made submissions, we asked further information. And I mean, one of the issues was that she wants more money. We asked for further documentation. Something was supplied, but unfortunately, it causes. I mean, there was a breakdown of complaints involving the Department of Justice, and then there was also a little report on the complaints received in the month of September. And what worried me from the Department of Justice breakdown that the office gave us, that there seems to be a number of issues that she's investigating, that seem dubious. So, you know, 1,254 complaints, the large bulk of them, 528, were appeal applications for leave to appeal not heard or not on the roll. Then there's issues of delays in the appeal and judgment. And there's another one low down, a court judgment delayed. Then there's the issue that the DG complained about of unfair labor practice in the department. So I think she would need to, and then there's things like conduct of the sheriff. I would have thought that the sheriff's board had their own complaint mechanism. So one would have wanted to have known whether that was followed, because she basically has, and then looking at the September breakdown document, anything that seemed to be involving a person other than an organ of state was immediately referred as out of side jurisdiction, which is correct. But largely everything else seemed to be being taken on, and that's what worried me. She does have a discretion, or the public protector has a discretion as to, and particularly where there are other avenues that can be followed. I have heard of her referring some matters to the Human Rights Commission. So was the reference, for example, on Marikana, of her referring that to the Human Rights Commission. But generally, it seemed to be that it was becoming one big advice office against government. And I thought it would be useful to have her back, because it is linked to the issue of funding, to give her an opportunity to explain this better. The other aspect that worries me is in terms of value for money. My understanding is that what one wants to see is a problem addressed, but the systematic problems then also being, systemic problems also being dealt with. Now, we specifically asked for information on the problems with the department and the master's office, which we were told we would get, and it never came. Wasn't supplied in terms of that. Maybe there was a misunderstanding. But it worried me, for example, the one written report that she did involve injustice, that the DG did not have it. She told us she did not have it, wasn't aware of it. And it's the question of how is the public protector going about things?
when she's investigating. One would expect her to contact the head of the department and say, I'm investigating this. So I think these are factors that are linked to me, for me, and then the other issue is, although she accounts only to the National Assembly, the problem I've got is she doesn't mean to listen to us. You know, so we say, look, we have a problem with three offices in a sparsely populated area of the country which is not so far apart. That's Freiburg, Grumman, and Upington. And what does she do? She closes Portobello. You know, it just seems as though what we say, we've said repeatedly, population-wise, you have too many staff in the Northwest and the Northern Cape. Move some of the, you know, the complaint is the caseload. But if you look at the caseload of Gauteng with the largest population, they have the largest caseload. But they don't have the most staff. So, and I've been raising that for the last, well, few years with her. I mean, since she's been public sector. So I do have a problem of you know, one says things. I think that's something more one should be putting into the report. I would like to see into the report a concern that the public protector doesn't seem to respond, take advice to what we ask. And as I'm talking about specifically those offices. But I do think that I don't know where our deadline is when we have to complete the report, but I would like to be able to ask, surely most of these justice things are outside of jurisdiction. And if one looks at the September catalogue, that most of those seem to be, could be referred elsewhere.
A note. I'm not unsympathetic to what the Honourable Jeffrey said, but at no point did we say to the public protector, this is the view of the committee, or this is a resolution of the committee. It is true that the Honourable Jeffrey always raises these questions. In fact, and I think I might have done that. But at no point did we say to her, this is what we'd like you to do. I'm not sure we should in any case. We raised the problem. And it's a transfer expenditure, but is it? I think we would have to make an explicit recommendation that we don't feel like voting the money for three offices in the Northwest. And there were answers given. They referred to what the
driven
yes. So I'm sympathetic to what the Honourable Giffey is arguing, but I think. But in fairness to the public protector, we would have to take a concrete decision of some description.
Shoppers Toilet first, and then Ms. Schaefer. So by the way, before you start, Ms. Shoppers Toilet, Ms. Romano informed me we've requested an extension for our BRRR report until next Tuesday.
Thank you, Jefferson. I sympathize with what Comrade Jeffrey is saying, and I think it is important for us to do what Honorable Smart is saying. According to the Constitution, committees of Parliament make recommendations in a report, table a report in Parliament, so that we can be able to follow it up. Because you see, if we don't put these things in a report and table in the legislature, they become, you know, in our language, caught. But if we are serious, we need to capture our discussion and resolution in a report. And once a report is tabled in Parliament, it becomes necessary for a department to do something about it. Because if they don't do it, we can follow it up with questions to the head of government business, who is the deputy president. And in that way, we can actually inform what we're. Otherwise, we are not going to get what we want.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure it's our job to tell public sector how to run your office. Obviously, it's relevant if she's asking for more money, how she's using existing funding. That is so. But I do think that it would be useful for you to come and clarify what those complaints are about, you know, appeals and so on and so forth, because I do think that is relevant to the BRRR report. And I think it is a separate issue, the other one, and you can certainly deal with that. But then we have to do it next week, is what I understand. Otherwise, you aren't going to have an opportunity. But I do think that at least we should get more answers as to what exactly those were about, to see if it is in fact exceeding the mandate and to what extent. Regarding funding.
Sure. I have a logistical problem, and I think you'll understand. We have a deadline on next Tuesday. Yes. So, how will we be able to call her before then? Probably not. Mr. Jeffrey?
I think the chances of getting her, I mean, we have to have her this week because Tuesday we will be adopting the report. So we can't... but I would suggest then that she just gets out to respond in writing, and it specifically is this breakdown that she gave us that issues such as delayed judgments, leave to appeal not being heard or not on the roll, appear to be the judgment delayed, the two categories. There was appeal / judgment delayed, and there was court / judgment delayed. And those would appear to be outside her jurisdiction.
And then we ask her comment on those precise instances, read against section 6.6.
Six
of the Public Protector Act,
right.
Namely that nothing in subsections 4 and 5 shall be construed as empowering the Public Protector to investigate the performance of judicial functions by any court of law. So she is also violating her own act on the face of what I see before me, but let's hear her on the subject.
What exactly the complaints were and how she resolved them? I think that is really...
Is the nature of complaints? They are right outside her powers. And inasmuch as it is her function to sit in judgment and then mediation of how other people exercise their public powers and public functions, it is truly problematic if the Public Protector herself is not exercising her powers properly, if she is acting outside her powers. So it is potentially serious. It's a very simple fact that she is dealing with these matters at all, unless what she has put down black on white on paper is not what we understand it to be, but I don't see what else it could be. You see, these are not just the results or the secretary lie of court judgments, like the implementation of maintenance orders. These are the functions of the courts themselves, and they are without her powers. She can't sit in judgment on other people and how they exercise public functions and then misconstrue her own. And it is, I would say, four square within precisely our function as the National Assembly, holding her to account whilst respecting and assisting her to clear this matter up. And we do so in the spirit that we are cooperating with her.
The other issue, though, was the point that we had asked her for. So I don't know, I'm not making any suggestions, but I'm just sort of raising it. We had asked her to give us details of the Master's office and the department. And she failed to do so. I mean, that document shows that there were 54 complaints against the Master's office. But when the Master was here, he had nothing to put to him. But so I don't know whether we should ask her again, if maybe express concern that we didn't have the opportunity. And then the other aspect is I'm quite interested, following the Director General's input, I'd like to know that reparations report, what communication she had with the Director General and with the Ministry.
On the reparations?
On that reparations report, because she refers in the report to interacting with two officials, sort of fairly junior officials in the department. She names them, and that was confirmed by the Director General. They are in the department. But it didn't appear, even though she was making a finding against the department, it did not appear as though, well, the DG was not aware of that report. So I'd like to know who she's communicating with in the department, or does she communicate with the head
I think that is worth pursuing. It's just a courtesy, in fact, from one very powerful figure, the public protector, to whoever heads the administration in whatever government department or entity. And it's also something sensible, because things go wrong when she consults only officials lower down. That particular report, she made the very strange recommendation that citizens should be able to go to magistrates to help them assess the amount of money in the president's funds. Now, that's not a very sensible suggestion, but, you know, I suppose that's an example of where it's none of our business. But I would like to have more information on the complaints that she lists for the Martyrs Office, of which there were 54 out of the 1,254. Because the master, the chief master, when he appeared before us, in most polite terms, described two practical examples. One of them was the person who approached the public protector. Somebody had died in testate. Now, the law determines what happens after that, the wife and the children. But he was none of the above. He was an uncle or a booty. And he wanted to know why he had not benefited from the estate for that purpose went to the public protector. Whereas, as the master says, I mean, these things are determined by the law. And you can't go to the public protector. You shouldn't be taking a case aligned to that. So I would like to hear more from her on examples like those.
Details of...
Yes, why and what. And, yeah.
I did recognize you and we moved past you, right? You let him adjust it.
Thanks, sir. I think as we continue to intend looking at the mandate of the Office of the Public Protector, we should actually also look to what extent her mandate extends into private business. It doesn't at all, but there are incidences where she has actually also investigated private business. That needs to be brought up, yes. I don't want to give an example because... No, it's really a bad example. I'm not giving any example. We can just talk to her about it. Just in case probably she's doing it, so she actually understands that she's not actually going into investigation of private business. It also emphasizes the idea that he makes findings or recommendations. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they are binding. I think that's very important. And one thing also that I want to actually follow up is, what is the delay in finalization of the cases in the Office of Public Protector? Because in terms of the number of complaints that she has, 2,700, half of that couldn't actually be finalized. Could it be because she doesn't have enough staff? Could it be because she takes too much more than what extends beyond the mandate? We need to look at that. We need to discuss with her about what is the cause, the main cause of delay in terms of finalization of matters in the office.
Her response was that she needs more investigation and hence her request for additional funds.
But also that's not an answer. She could actually say that, you know, mainly we see the type of cases that we are entering. These are the kinds of obstacles that we are encountering. And this is why, therefore, we will have this big backlog.
Right. Sure, I should put that down.
Yes,
in the nature of the delay. Anything else, honorable members? No. Our deadline for BRRR report is definitely next week. That request has been granted. All right.
Are we done now with the public project law? For now? Okay. I'm hoping to get it before the end of the day today. If who allows it? I'm downloading it onto a flash drive. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. If I'm able to, yes. Otherwise, I'll just give you a hard copy. Quite a lot. Quite a lot. Oh. That's the point of making, you know. I was sitting on the weekend emailing everything to you, and then this one just, what happened here? And it just refused. It said, no, can't be sent. Spoke to someone, and they said, no, that's too big. So, I don't have a, I hear what you're saying, but I don't have a response for you. Okay, is there anything else, honorable members, in the last 2 weeks of our engagement with the department and the relevant agencies, aside from the public, that you wish to reflect on? Yes. Okay.
Talk about the Honourable Jeffrey's proposal not to build the fort in Mpumalanga. You're not. One, you see, the virtue of it is, whatever it is, you make one really big cut, then you run it to spend there sitting between little cuts everywhere else, and further crippling institutions which are already struggling. That's it.
Jay, I
just about both.
No, that's full of Quanah's fault. Yeah, I didn't want to be specific, but the issue was, I mean, and just for the members that were not there who are giving me dirty looks, everybody, with the exception of the public sector, is having to take a 1 cent in the first year, 2% in the second year, and 3% cut in the third year of the medium-term budget expenditure framework period. Everybody in justice. The result is quite alarming from the point of view of the NPA, and particularly the NPA. The issue with the courts or the department was that we know, I mean, it's something that was raised before, don't keep building more courts when you can't maintain them. We did raise that, I think, in the budget process. But the issue was that, I didn't want to be specific to any court, although Mpumalanga High Court, which is required, is the most expensive. But I would rather have seen it as a general point rather than specific, to say that the committee is extremely concerned about, or that the department should curtail its building of new courts in order to ensure that it has an ability to have the funds necessary to maintain existing courts and money can be used elsewhere. So I would rather phrase it more general than saying the Mpumalanga High Court should not be built. So that was the one, a sort of general point of rather than building more courts, put the money into maintaining the existing ones. And then, Chair, I think other observations, alarm at the NPA cuts. They were the most worrying. I don't see why the public sector doesn't also have to have the 1, 2, and 3. Because, you know, the public protector doesn't get any money back like the SIU. The public protector doesn't result in anyone being sent to jail like the NPA. for crimes they've committed. I mean, Treasury seems to very much like the public protector. The public protector is very important. The results are I mean, it's the NPA that's going to end up sending people, ensuring people get convicted and punished. Those are the main ones. I think then generally HRC, I do think we should look. The one thing with it, and I presume members saw the Treasury response to our BRR from,
was it last year?
I think members need to have a look at that.
Okay.
I wasn't at all happy with it.
Yeah, is there someone
they basically kept a veto. I thought that they were not, we asked for things. I mean, with the HRC.
Yeah, we should look at that. I think,
I need someone to explain. I'm very much to interrupt you, Lapis, because I've not clear my mind. When we take a decision, they have that veto right?
The process, as I understand it, is we take, the House takes the decision.
Right.
It then goes to Treasury for comment. And then if, I think the Appropriations Committee recommends to the House, and the House agrees, then the budget is changed. I'm not sure if it's done now or if it's done in the new year. Now, basically, on the HRC, we said last time we thought they should get more money, and they basically, their response was they can do what they, you know, they must work within their existing arrangements. There were other aspects where they just didn't respond at all. So I do think members should look at that, and I do think we should maybe make a comment that these responses are not really adequate to understanding. We appreciate that the cake is not as big as it should be, that everybody's wanting more money, but can they at least please give us adequate responses and reasons why they're not supporting? So, okay, those would be my general ones. Obviously, I think members need to look at it, but I think in fairness to the research unit, they need, before they draft what they think we want, we should be giving them more detail as to what we say.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've got a situation with the Polokwane building, that court building that burnt down.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, the government is a self-insurer. So there's going to be a massive expenditure there, if I am correct, but I understand the government is a self-insurer. So there's going to be massive capital expenditure that's going to be necessary there very quickly. I don't know whether we need, before we even put in our report, to get a report on that, because, you know, we should just ask the department whether they want to comment on additional expenditure that might arise as a result of that fire. The whole building is gone. Well, they can't use, I mean, can they use it, replacing records, all that type of thing? That's the one issue. The second problem, and it ties in what Mr. Jeffrey said about National Treasury's response, we ask them to respond, and then we can go to the Appropriations Committee and make our case up to the Parliamentary Committee. They then can recommend to the House, but notwithstanding what Treasury has said, if it fits within the fiscal framework, then they can, we as Parliament can agree to it. But now that's a challenge, because when you get the medium term Thursday, all expectations are that the deficit is going to increase because of the slowing economic growth. Therefore, there's going to be even a bigger haircut required. Therefore, there's going to be even bigger pressure on Treasury and on the Finance and Appropriations Committee to find the additional funds that are going to be necessary as opposed to budget in February. The situation has deteriorated dramatically in terms of the national economics and fiscal position since February, due mainly to strikes and to the decreased economic growth and therefore less revenue that is generated. That will get clarity on Thursday, but all the indications are that the deficit is going to be bigger than forecast. And of course, the biggest ratings agencies have now downgraded the country, which means our debt service costs are higher. So this all puts a lot of pressure on the fiscus. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't still argue for, as we've said, the 680 million and try to get as much as we can. But other departments are going to argue for that. And if we can make out the case, so if the deficit is slightly higher, then that will have to be so. But these are critical service delivery, and I don't think we can be quite, it's not the same apple. The NPA is crucial. So we can make a strong case. I would suggest that we find out and maybe have a look at the Appropriations Committee, because I seem to remember in
the beginning of this year, the chair, Mr. Sigoni, saying he received no reports from other committees. And I found that strange. I might have misheard him, but I didn't understand it in the sequence of things. But clearly, my understanding is we can make a submission to Treasury and then to the Appropriations Committee. We've got a power to amend the budget within the fiscal framework, and that's the challenge.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. I really understand the situation of the Eurozone. I understand the vandalization of Polokwane. I understand the dilapidations of other. But I think Mpumalanga should not be made such a bad land. Definitely not. You know, people in that area are very poor. They can't afford to be going to Pretoria and Johannesburg. I remember when I was still concerned for finance in the Indian Bombo, I did make some research, which actually reflected that a place like Bushbuck Ridge has got the highest unemployment in the country, in South Africa. So we can't be sitting here and saying the cars must be in that area. I think what we should do is that our wedding should be cut everything else except for the court in Bumala.
Thank you, Chair. I think the presentation by the Department of Justice was quite encouraging. There's a lot of improvement. More still needs to be done. And I think one thing that we need to just remind them about is filling the vacancies. If you look at the gaps in terms of what was presented, what causes problems sometimes is areas where there are the vacancies are not filled. Like, for example, DDG corporate services. If you look at that AR report that was given, it's very big. And you can see that it doesn't have proper recipients. I guess once they've got the DDG corporate service, for example, just give me an example of this one. Then that area will be polished. It will be much better than what has been presented here. Also, those vacancies will affect the performance in terms of the second. Because when you plan, then you plan in accordance to the number of vacancies. So there's no way in which you can actually be in the position to carry out your plan to the fullest if you don't have enough staff to actually do that. And another thing is to think of, in terms of the cuts, to really think of what has been suggested in terms of cuts in relation to the complaints, the magistrate complaints. I think we need to follow that. We have raised it in the discussion. I think it's something that is something that needs to be followed. I'm not sure how we're going to follow it up, just to be sure that it's not something that falls through the cracks. And magistrate salary is the matter that was taken to court, and there's a judgment also on this. In terms of courts, the building of courts, my major concern, which I still want to reiterate, is the amount of time that is taken to build the course. And I think what would be important for now, sorry about Mpumalanga for a while, and I'm sure it's not because Mpumalanga is forgotten completely, but when you look at the problem in terms of the structures that they are busy with, the feeling you get is that maybe they need to just complete these courses. You know, there must come a time when they're completed and we know where we are in terms of the course, and it would then therefore allow us in a comfortable manner to look at where do we go to move forward. Because for now, they've got buildings that they are still grappling with. South and South High Court, I think they're still going to take 2 years to complete that building. It's just too much. And it affects even daily business. So what is important is that when they start building, they need to actually do proper due diligence. They avoid these delays for the various types of reasons why they delay, but we wonder whether their due diligence was actually accurate. And also, when it comes to the public sector, I think as a committee, we need to reflect on the working conditions of service for the daily public protector. The manner in which the public protector is appointed and the salary package, all of that. Moreover, what is good is that we are doing this at the end of the term of the current deputy public protector. So if you're ever going to come into that position, we actually find that we've actually sorted out all of these things. Because, you know, the conditions for the public protector, him or herself, are so vastly different from the conditions of the deputy public protector. And if somebody's right hand or left hand person of somebody, they shouldn't attend by themselves as either one of the staff members within the office. That itself will create chaos within the office. So we need to revisit that and then look at how we can actually realign it. Otherwise, all in all, I think we are really moving and happy that the special investigation unit, they really cut down on the number of consultants that they are using, because previously they were very worried about it. And for now, they're saying they only have 25, and the contracts of 25 are short, while they're actually trying to get permanent staff members. I think that's very much positive. And I think we need to continue to be conscious of also the external funding. Remember, at some point, they were saying that it was something like 40% of the funding was from external funding, and we were actually worried about it. Not that we don't want to get assistance, but we shouldn't find that it's something that's about government and government work that is solely privately funded, because they need to literally give us a problem in terms of accountability.
I just wish if you would allow me to put something on the record.
On Mpumalanga, yes, no, on Mpumalanga. It is only right that every province in this country which has its own provincial division or will have, should have a high court appointment. Some of my best friends are from Mpumalanga and Nelspruit and Bombela in particular, and I want to make that clear. Judges Mlombo, Judge Motapero, both either come from there or have historic links there. It is an important part of the country, and I support everything that the Honourable Cecilia said. The reason why it is worth looking at the building of the court there is that no foundation stone has been laid. It is up on tender. It is at that stage where you can reverse the process. A tender can be cancelled. That is the only reason why the Mpumalanga High Court is the one that was under discussion. It is not because of any kind of victimization of one province over another or one court over another. It is because that particular project, running into, I think, 560 million, and which will grow, is currently out on tender. The tender could be cancelled. We could save a potential 560 million. And I just wish to say that I'm sure it is more prudent to phrase it as had been proposed that any new building program should be stopped, relatively corrupted. I'm sure that's more prudent. But if I may just be quite clear, I will get into awful trouble if people think I just want the old Worcester Hall to fall under Pretoria and the people who live there and who are my friends. Thank you.
Thank you. Now my colleague has renamed Honourable Shoppe to the Honourable Cecilia. So, Chair, I just want to discuss on three issues. I think, yeah, I do think it's disparity between one institution having to take no cuts when others have to take cuts. I don't think that's necessarily fair. I do think the department has made out a very good case for extra funding, and we must try and support as much as possible. Particularly in the light of the last recent events, I think we need to focus on
enabling them to maintain the courts properly, the existing courts, and I think that maybe links in with what you said about not building any new courts. I mean, now, the latest on Polokwane now is they say the fire extinguishers weren't working. Now, I mean, if that's the situation, this is completely and utterly unacceptable. We're going to never build any other courts if we don't have the existing ones properly looked after. So I would like to suggest we include that, and also we need to, you know, accelerate the IT systems. And I know we have given my forward, but maybe until the IT systems are properly updated and maximized, you're not going to have anything functioning. And even the maintenance system with the EFT transfer and so on, if you're having proper ADSL lines or whatever connections, you're not going to get, and it can hugely improve service delivery in the department. So that was the one thing, and the other is legal aid. I mean, I think the work that they've done has been so excellent, and they're still battling to get enough people, and if we can give them extra money, I really think that would also be beneficial. I mean, it's looking after the rest of the poor who cannot afford services, and those who are maybe middle, who, you know, to access civil litigation, and I think we, you know, their record speaks for itself. They aren't wasting money, they're using it optimally. Thanks.
I really would urge that we don't specify. I mean, the issue basically was that given the department's difficulty in maintaining courts, should it still be building to the extent that it is? And I think they had indicated they've cut down. I don't think we should say stop building, because there are certain courts where there are too many. There aren't enough courts, and it's basically blocking everything up. So there might be a need in some place to actually build enough courts. But I think what we should be saying is, and I don't think we should mention Mpumalanga one way or the other. The reason, as Ms. Fussler said, is that Polokwane is nearly finished. So there's nothing that can be done with that. And whereas in Mpumalanga they are just putting it out, they've just put it out to tender. I think the issue is that the way we should phrase it is the department should look very carefully at whether in this current period the building of in deciding to build a new court anywhere, whether it is necessary in this current period or whether it can in fact wait. So it's sort of something like that which leaves it open. Obviously, if I don't know what the state is at Nelspruit and Mbombela, whether they can function, and I know that, but whether they can, whether they've got other buildings that can be used temporarily in terms of but that's something we can explore. You know, will depend on if they do go for that decision. But that was the one I'd really raised. Then I think in addition, with the caseflow management system, we didn't have really that much to evaluate it. I mean, obviously, the stuff that law project produced, I think, was quite worrying. We were told by both the NPA and the department that the Chief Justice was convening, or they spoke very highly of the Chief Justice's initiative. We haven't had any report of that, but the one thing I would like to see us putting in the report is that people who unnecessarily delay court proceedings should be subject to disciplinary action. So if it is a people who unnecessarily delay, well, that's what I'm going to get onto. So I mean, and if the honourable members will remember, so if it is, for example, some of the points in the thing of a prosecutor not pitching and not giving a good reason, the disciplinary action should be taken. If you remember, I asked the NPA about that. If it is court officials who don't pitch, it's again disciplinary action. So I don't know why I've provoked some consternation on my left and my right. Yes, but no, the issue is, though, it's the disciplinary action thing, because I think the response that we got from I can't remember now whether it was the department or the NPA, though they hadn't thought of that. And I think it's that aspect. So Chair, there's that aspect. We did also raise the point, and again, it's not something that can be a hard and fast rule, the concern that people would be arrested. Obviously, people get arrested for crimes that, when they're committing crimes in the process, but that often people get arrested when they don't need to be arrested. They're not going to run away. And that then causes, lengthens the delay. They should be, you know, so, and I think it's something the police have been asked, but I don't know how one phrases it, to look at that issue of arrests that are not necessary to taking place too soon, premature arrests. Yeah. But that was just, yeah, look, I don't know, we can look at some way of dealing with it. Other than that, the Guardian Fund, you know, we had a report a while ago of the how their services were only available in very few centres. They have been indicated, and I think it was an annexure to the July report they sent us, that they have extended. And just to say, you see, I mean, to my mind, I don't see why the Guardian Fund can't be extended without securing huge costs. Because it basically means putting an individual in an existing master's office or simply training staff in that master's office to act as a soapbox. To stop people having to go, people in the Eastern Cape, whether you're in Port Elizabeth or Matatiel, that you have to go to Bantustown. So that's effectively what it was before. So I think, yeah, those points.
I don't know how to put it here, but I'm just saying that I don't believe that as a country we don't have enough funds. I believe we should actually press upon investigating units in our country to actually repossess properties of people who milk the state. Because there is a lot of people who just take away from the state resources that should be earmarked for things delivered. And if we do enough for follow-up and actually repossess those, you know, we can have enough money.
All right. Firstly, I just to respond to the Honourable Pilar Majake with regard to the salary and benefits of the public protector and deputy. There's a process at the moment whereby this will be shifted to the Independent Commission. So both the public protector and the deputy public protector, you know, left will have to be found whereby somebody makes the request of that independent commission, no longer this committee or parliament. So that as far as that's concerned. What's still outstanding, of course, is amending legislation. So to come back to the question of what we are discussing, I don't agree that the Mpumalanga High Court should be stopped. I think it would be grossly unfair. I could think of a number of other projects that could be stopped right now. Yes, could. Not necessarily in the Department of Justice, in other places. I fail to see how Treasury can simply in one fell swoop say to the Department of Justice, you must cut by one. It's not, people, it's not often culture. Not sports. No, I'm saying that. I'm saying that I if I offend anyone in saying that, well, too bad. But it's justice. And the wheels grind. And once they start moving and you say, hang on a second, just put on the brakes, you're asking for serious problems. And they're seeing it already. They're saying, hold back with the Mpumalanga High Court. What else? The court DG is shipping a state right now, as well as the senior staff. And I understand why, because they don't know where they're going to cut. But that's the import. And I agree with the Honourable Shopee Solet. I don't believe that as far as the Department of Justice is concerned. Money can't be found. I believe money is there. And I believe Treasury must make it their responsibility to find it. Well, wherever. Already, yes. So already now, the burning of the Polokwane Magistrate Court, there's a sense of panic. Where are you going to find the money to rebuild it? And is that what we've become? Yes. Is that what we've become now? Does it mean now that the Polokwane Magistrate Court, well, it can't be rebuilt? That's essentially what Treasury is telling us. Like I said, it is not art and culture. It is not sport. It's justice. So that's my own personal view. I believe that it was wrong of them to say to the Department of Justice, cut by $680 million. Which brings me back to the point raised by the Honourable Philani Magaki about vacancy. The DG, in during one of the breaks, said to me, well, I hear what you're saying about the vacancies. How do I fill the vacancies if I don't have this $680 million? Because in order to fill a vacant post, you have to have the necessary budget to pay the person that you employ. And if she doesn't have the $680 million, that's essentially where they're going to start. Are there any of the vacant posts that they really desperately need? I know that that's where they're going to start cutting. Good people, personally, I hear what you're saying, Swat. We'll go the route of the appropriations committee. We're going to find an opportunity of having a quiet word with the chairperson who is off the record and see how best we can perhaps motivate our case and find a way whereby even if some of the $680 million is given back to the Department of Justice. Those are just some of my views as far as that's concerned.
So I hear you well that the DG is saying that some of these vacancies that are available are not budgeted for.
No, they've been made, she's been told to cut.
They've
used the
money. Yes. But for now, they have to cut. But we talked about the positions that have been vacant for it.
The point she's making is that money that is budgeted for the vacant post is being used in other important work of the department. It's wrong. Well, how does she do that when she's faced with this enormous cut? See, it's easy for you and me to say, listen, prioritize. She could well do that, but at the end of the day, she's going to come back here and say, look, I tried my level best, and that's the best I could do.
Sorry to interrupt on this one. Remember what she said to us about the performance assessment? That she tried to go back to 2002, trying to put back, back retrospectively, which I think is something that is not really necessary. This needs to have, indeed, because that's not how the system operates. And for now, it will happen like that, because certainly nobody has really a dedicated person for nexus of this nature within the department. Because by actually saving on a vacancy, it also becomes a way of actually using money at the same time.
So even the Auditor General conceded that this $680 million cut presents a serious challenge to the department. That came from the Auditor General's office.
Allow me just to respond to Khan. No, you've had to pay people respective. These are their legal rights that have been affected. And there are the two separate issues. One was the job evaluation exercise, which Willie Hofmeyer said has them now in a state of hysteria because they've lost in two courts. And the inflation has run and come to presently, I think, $140 million, but potentially $1.5 billion. And they simply don't know what to do. But these are people that acquired rights to this money. And the second one, which the Department of Justice has as a problem, is that people's performance assessments were not done under Simulani. And that creates a whole separate problem. And her answer to us was, she's aware of it, she's been working as sister, she has now worked backwards at least to the point she was appointed. And people have been assessed
only paid out to the degree that she can. She's doing it slowly, incrementally, because that's all she can do. And she hasn't even looked at the SMS or senior management staff out of the advocate to Melanie Arias, whose assessment went out. These are acquired rights. You can't escape it. And the courts will uphold them every time.
As long as you recall, that this began with Simulani. It's not Simulani who created the problem. So, you know, now she's saying, well, I've been ordered to do it. And if I must do it, where's the fund?
Problematic. She's talking about performance, and performance is not about people really doing well and being giving bonuses only. There are those who didn't perform and who are not sanctioned. Now we're talking about rewards only. But anyway, let's see how they deal with it. Just that it sounds bad in terms of how HR makes that actually supposed to be handled. Because you can't retrospectively also punish the ones that didn't perform.
Anything else, Christine and Judy, you want to add? No? All right. We are having fun. Mr. Jeffy?
Different issue.
Yes? What about it? We don't know the VRR for now.
Formally that the work submission, that's the thing around the hearing of appeals by the FCA.
Yeah.
Were documents submitted by Mr. Bassett. LASA are opposing the amendment. I did speak to them. There was a specific person, I can't remember his name, in Joburg, and they said actually they were behind the main judgment, which is the one that cut out that provision for the magistrate court. There seems to be some little ground in terms of limiting the areas where you don't need the record. But Chair, we've had SCA judges have said they want to work. I think there were only two submissions, one from someone who's in favor and then last the one. We've had the SCA judges would want to come and talk to us if we are not in favor of their amendment. So I think we would need to organize a meeting where we have them, and then we invite this person to LASA. It's the head of their, you know, they've got this sort of, what do they call it, sort of specialist litigation or whatever, groundbreaking litigation section. It's the person from there to come and make it. So I just wanted to raise the impact litigation. So I just wanted to raise, we would need, before we finalize that bill, we would need to propose. The other issue would be on the issue of retrospectivity. It could be retrospective if rights aren't affected, but the problem with LASA is that it doesn't affect rights. It's basically an issue of they think in certain cases, even where the person was represented, you can't probably consider an appeal if there's no record, or if the record's not made available. And I think the difficulty is I think the NTA judges were taking a little bit of a shortcut. The section gets cut out from the magistrate court. Might end up in the same place as the High Court, even though the High Court's are better. And then, Chair, lastly, I hope that Ms. Shekhar will, when she goes to the Magistrate Commission, duly take a copy of the public proceedings of the Court on Reparation and discuss with the Magistrate how they're going to assist members of the public giving knowledge.
To see what is available in the public domain anyway.
No, I'm prepared to commit this, Ms. Ulla, derogatory comments with any member of Parliament to go to the Senate.
All right. So then, I hope you've listened to Mr. Jeffrey. What he's proposing is that we invite the FCA and LASA.
I have been a
All right. Mr. Swart?
If we have an FCA here,
we are.
Can we not ask them their views on the competition appeal court at the same time? If that's very...
absolutely right, because it's not a matter they addressed in their remarks.
They never
remarked
it.
Yeah.
And we'd like to hear
it.
Only, no.
The only thing is that, I mean, we deal with the Superior Court and the Constitutional Amendment tomorrow. My only concern is that I don't know when we will get this meeting with the FCA and the other, that, you know, if we can fit it in, yes, but if it delays us, no. Because remember that that amendment was in the introduced bill. You know, that's not a committee of an amendment we have come up with. It's an amendment that was in the bill that was passed for public comment.
What we've been discussing is changing the test of the Constitutional Court, which would have an impact on a number of aspects, including the FCA jurisdiction. So there's it's almost a package of amendments to the introduced constitutional amendment. So there are implications either way. If we talk about the bill as introduced, then we are looking at a much broader constitutional court jurisdiction that would hear all appeals. But here it is a suggestion. I understand Honourable Jeffrey's concern about time. If we can fit it in, let's see if we can. It would be interesting to hear the views. I'm trying to be as open-minded about the issue as possible as well.
Now, the answer to the Honourable Jeffrey is quite simply that the last thing we saw from the FCA was their remarks on what was then the 19th. Okay, and it doesn't address this point, and I'm afraid I didn't get around to going to find my old copy of the 19th, but it's probably not like that in there. But that last, I give you the FCA's, two sheets from the FCA's comment on the 19th. I didn't go and look at the 19th bill itself. But I think, now, we saw the FCA in their courts, and I suppose that the Honourable Jeffrey is saying that they could have raised it there if they wanted to raise it. But it was not formally a meeting about the vote, although we did discuss the matter of jurisdiction. I mean, and I think you can't expect of judges or courts to respond to public invitations for comments. It's not how it works. We deal in a far more formal, decorous, and respectful way with the courts. So I think it is worth, depending, you see, how far your thinking has gone. But I think it is proper, as Steve has argued from the start, on the basis of Audi Alfred, it is proper to hear their views, since we've taken those of my good friend Dana. And it is proper, and if it is possible, this opportunity having opened up, then simply why not?
Thank you.